House Committee on Energy and the Environment, Monday, March 5th, 2007, 1 p.m. in Hearing Room C. Chair, Representative Jackie Dingfeld.
Work session on House Bill 2172. Actually, I need to, I guess, open up the committee. Open up the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you for your patience. And Pat, could you describe the bill and the amendments, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. House Bill 2172 directs the Environmental Quality Commission to establish a goal to reduce diesel emissions. It creates the Clean Diesel Engine Fund to provide grants and loans to repower and retrofit diesel engines. Creates income tax credits for repowering and retrofitting diesel engines, and extends existing tax credits for purchasing new engines that meet clean diesel emission standards when they're purchased before 2012. We have in front of you a couple amendments to the bill. House Bill 2172-1 amendment includes an amendment suggested by Representative Tobias Reed that he spoke about it at the hearing the other day. That would change the goals of the Environmental Quality Commission should establish a goal to substantially reduce the risk to school children from diesel engine emissions by 2013. There's also an amendment, the LC-2 amendment, which at the suggestion of the Legislative Fiscal Office removes a provision that would have allowed DEQ to apply for grants to support the clean diesel program without application for legislative review and approval of the grant request. And then you also have one additional piece of testimony in front of you from TriMet that was submitted today regarding House Bill 2172.
Thank you, Kat. And we have Paul Siebert here, who is going to explain. We basically have Paul Siebert from LFO and then Andy Ginsberg. Andy, if you want to come up, from the Department of Environmental Quality. I think both of you want to tell us about the dash twos, and whoever wants to go first.
Certainly. Madam Chair, I can go first. Again, Paul Siebert from the Legislative Fiscal Office. As you know, the legislature has a review process for competitive grants established for the Ways and Means Committee during the legislative session and the Emergency Board during the interim. And we saw the language in House Bill 2172, and we're concerned and just wanted to make sure also that there was some clarification about how the process works. For example, with this particular program that's as envisioned, the department would be requesting in their agency request budget and the governor's recommended budget federal funds limitation to expend money from grants to address diesel emissions. The way the process works is if we give the agency that federal funds limitation for those grants, really it's implicit that we're allowing them to apply for the grants in the first place because we're allowing them to spend the money from the grants. And we also often, for these kinds of programs, can make it very clear in the budget report language and narrative that the agency has the ability to go out and seek funds from various federal sources and competitive grants up to the $1.5 million. And then if they were to need additional federal funds limitation, they could always come back at a later date and request additional limitation authority, because in our discussions with the agency, and I'm sure that they will admit the $1.5 million is really an estimate of how much they think they'll be able to leverage out of the federal government, but by no means a guarantee of federal monies.
Do you want to add anything, Andy?
Madam Chair, Andy, and members of the committee, Andy Ginsberg, Air Quality Administrator with DEQ. I don't really have anything to add.
So, just for clarification, Paul, in essence, lines 20 and 21 are not needed because they're redundant. What's an existing authority?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that would be correct. The only exemption from this process that I know of that exists is for the Oregon University System, and that is because of the massive volume of grants and federal solicitations that they go through every biennium. And if you're familiar with the budget process at all, you'll know that various other parts of the Oregon University System are kind of outside the state budget system. For example, their positions aren't in the state position inventory control system. So they've been given the exemption, and they're the only ones that I know of.
And I guess I shouldn't say redundant. It's basically incorrect, I mean, because that's not the way the process is currently.
Madam Chair, what you'd be doing is setting up a perpetual exemption for them so that any future legislature would have to change the law if they wanted to look at these grants at all. In fact, when the federal funds limitation is built into the agency's budget, they can continue to do this, seeking these grants, but there's always the review process during the legislative budget hearings every 2 years that would kind of revisit that issue.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions about this particular amendment? Representative Burley and Representative McPherson.
I'm still not quite clear why we need to give them this exemption. If I understand, Paul, what you said, OUS right now, the Oregon University System, is the only department that currently has such an exemption.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, to my knowledge, that's correct.
Is there a rationale as to why the OUS currently has this exemption, and does that same rationale apply in this case, or is there a different one?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I am not privy to when that was passed, what the rationale was. My best guess is that they have such a huge volume of grants that come through the various institutions that they're applying for on a continual basis that if we were to insert them in the review process for the legislature, that you would be constantly seeing all kinds of grants in front of you, and I believe that they decided that they could give them an exemption, but it's certainly something I could research further and give some additional information.
Somebody is very close to their microphone. I think, Representative Gentry, you might want to move your... Here we go. Having a little feedback there.
And again, Paul, correct me here if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding in the Ways and Means process that the department, and understandably the application period sometimes for federal grants, if you will, you know, they actually end up submitting the request and then coming to the legislature asking for permission after the fact, which I'm okay with because I understand the dynamics. But it's my understanding that they don't necessarily get the federal funding limitation until after they get the grant award.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, that's correct. Typically.
Okay. So then you said that they already have the federal limitations.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I didn't mean to say that they have it currently. They have it proposed in their budget for the next biennium. They have the limitation included in their governor's recommended budget for the 07-09 biennium.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, thank you. No further questions, but I do just want to say at this point in time, I have not been convinced this is an exemption that needs to be given. So I'm open, I'm listening, but I'm not convinced.
And Madam Chair, Representative Burley, just to point out, I think the amendment in front of you is to remove that exemption.
Yeah, remove that, by the way.
Yeah.
The amendment in front of you is to delete those two lines, which would remove that authorization.
If I could go on to my question, maybe this might shed some light on it.
I stand corrected.
Yeah. I mean, that is the impact of the amendment, is to get rid of the exemption, but I was trying to understand more fully why it is we don't need it. It sounds like it's because we think that the process that this language on lines 20 and 21 of page 3 would exempt this process from, we don't need to exempt it. It's an appropriate and useful process for this kind of grant activity. Is that a fair understanding?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, that's our office's belief.
Okay, that's I'm fine.
Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions on that one? Okay. And then are there any questions? Do you want to talk a little bit about the dash ones? I know that Representative Reed couldn't be here, so I didn't know if you wanted to just mention. We had discussed this. Colleagues, if you remember, Representative Reed came and offered a friendly amendment to insert, as Kat already mentioned, the goal that the commission shall include a target to substantially reduce risk to school children from diesel engine emissions, and it's really to target school buses and look at retrofitting school buses as a priority.
Madam Chair, Kennedy Ginsburg with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Representative Reed was interested in this amendment because he saw information showing that children are at extra risk from diesel exhaust. They have higher respiratory rates than adults do, and so their exposure is more dangerous. And many states have given higher priority to addressing school buses first and then the rest of diesel engines second. This amendment still provides a lot of flexibility for the Environmental Quality Commission, but makes a statement that focusing on children first is important.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions on that?
Yes. Madam Chair, my question is, does the amendment substantially change the way this program would be administered and the priorities for grants that are provided?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, it will cause the Environmental Quality Commission, when they're establishing goals, to provide extra focus on children, but there are many other criteria in the bill in terms of cost effectiveness and exposure to other sensitive populations that will also be weighed, so it won't completely turn the bill on its head, but it does add children as an important priority.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Am I right in reading this that a child that started middle school this year would not receive any relief under this bill?
Maybe a point of clarification.
The date of 2017, and then in here the date of 2013.
Do you want to explain why that by the end of 2013 was?
Yes, when
the program sunsets.
All right, Madam Chair, Representative Jensen. The bill currently has a goal to achieve an acceptable level of risk from diesel emissions in 10 years, and this amendment would direct the commission to try and achieve that goal for children in 5 years. So it's speeding up by twice how quickly we would try and reduce risk to children. And, of course, we would like to do it a lot faster, but it's a matter of how much money is going to be available, and so we've got basically a 5-year plan and a 10-year plan to try and reduce risk in Oregon. But hopefully we can focus on the highest emitting buses first and use our cost effectiveness criteria to really target the money to where it's going to do the most good in the early years.
And just a clarification as far as the sunset currently, is there a sunset on the, I know there's the existing fund and then the new fund.
There's, Madam Chair, the only sunset that I'm aware of in the bill is on one of the tax credits. Mm-hmm. And the grant program itself doesn't have a sunset, but it has to be funded each year. There's no automatic funding.
Any other questions? All right. Well, we have to go find our member again, but we will take a motion unless there's other questions for the panel. Yes? Okay.
Madam Chair, I move LC1 and LC2 amendments, if I can do them together, to House Bill 2172.
Okay, Representative Cannon moves the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2172. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Okay, hearing none, those amendments are adopted. And we'll take a motion for the bill.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2172 as amended by the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments to the floor with due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to the House Revenue Committee by prior reference.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Cannon. That was a mouthful. Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2172 as amended with the dash 1s and the dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to House Revenue Committee. Is there any discussion? Okay. Those of the opinion that House Bill 2172 should be reported to the floor with due pass recommendation, refer to revenue. We'll vote aye. Those opposed vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith.
Excused.
Representative Byers.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Burley.
Aye.
Representative Cannon.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Chair Dingfelder.
Aye. Motion having received the required majority is declared passed. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2172. Thank you, Paul. It's going to revenue.
It's
going to revenue. Yeah. And they'll put a carrier on it, I'm assuming, revenue. Yeah. Okay, next we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2118, which is the Underground Injection Control Program. And Kat, could you describe that in any amendments, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. House Bill 2118 authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to establish fees that would directly support the EQ administration of the program. The Underground Injection Control Program. And that protects groundwater sources from contamination by underground injection of stormwater and other wastewater. You have in front of you a couple amendments. LC-2 amendment directs that all penalty funds that the EQ recovers for underground injection control program violations will be paid into the Watershed Improvement Grant Fund. And the LC-3 amendment in front of you inserts fee amounts that hadn't been agreed to with stakeholders at the time the bill was drafted. It also clarifies that fees apply to common roof drains only when they've been determined to be an environmental risk to groundwater.
Thank you. And I'd like to call up Greg Aldrich from DEQ. And if you could walk us through the amendments.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Aldrich. I'm the Government Relations Manager at DEQ, and with me is Rodney Blake, our DEQ Senior Hydrogeologist. DEQ is proposing House Bill 2118-3 amendment. This is to clarify our intent to exempt most single-family roof drains from the UIC fee program. This would be consistent with our testimony that you heard on February 16th and in the follow-up memo that we provided last week. We recently learned that the language proposed in the Dash 1 amendment, which you saw on the February 16th, was not adequate to exempt single-family roof drains. So before you is proposed Dash 3 amendment, which makes this change by inserting in line 5 into for the subsurface injections of fluids from a common roof drain added these words, determined to be an environmental risk to groundwater, comma, and then continue with $100 for each subsurface injection well. We will define environmental risk in the rule, and until rulemaking is completed, we'll make a case-by-case determination. In most cases, most residential structures would be exempt from the fee. There can be some cases where there is a definite environmental risk, even for single-family residential structures. If you'd like, Rodney can provide some examples of how this exemption would work and other key elements.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful, just to clarify.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Rodney Weick with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, Northwest Region, Senior Hydrogeologist. And with the UIC program, what we had looked at in this and examples where this exemption would apply is that the majority of single-family residences we consider very low risk as far as pollutant loading goes for the runoff, and therefore we would be looking at exempting these under this statute. Where you may run into a residential structure of having a problem would be where there would be an industrial facility where there may be a relatively high pollutant load fallout from air quality issues, and that would be addressed at that point. This would be a very rare incidence.
Does anybody have any questions about this amendment for the panel? Representative Cannon.
Question. Why, I think I understand the purpose of the amendment. Why not simply exempt residential housing, for instance, from this program, rather than using this method of environmental risk?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, what we're looking at from environmental risk is consistent with what our policies have been addressing all along, including, as you see in this, in our fee structure that's being proposed. It's when you look at the risks sector on this, we do, in the fee schedule, pretty much exempt the residential structures altogether. In the fee bill that's being proposed, we start with commercial as a risk. And looking at this, is what this does is give us the authority to be able to actually exempt the residential structures.
Well, yes, I do. And the follow-up is, if it clearly gives you the authority to exempt residential structures, why not simply exempt them in the bill? If that's your intention and that's the way the fees have been proposed, I think it just, for transparency's sake and clarity, I'm just curious why you didn't go that route.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, I think I'll go back to the example, all by being a rare case. In the instance where you have a fairly high industrial area, there is a potential where you can end up with some heavy metals, lead, mercury, or others that are carried in the air pollutant that do fall out in these areas. And what this gives us the ability is to protect groundwater even in those areas where we would look at that before exempting them to make sure that they do have a very low risk in that case.
Madam Chair, do you have any of those? Can you tell me where any of those places, those sort of, let's say, closely watched places might be, those areas that contain enough industrial contaminants to make drainage even from residential rooftops a potential risk?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, yes. Primarily one example would be in Northwest Portland area where residents in that area are already concerned and at looking at those issues and air toxics and the fallout patterns. And what I believe what we're seeing is that from immediate source, you're seeing a significant decrease in air pollutants coming away from that facility, and these would be addressing potentially those residential structures that are very close to those sources.
Any other questions on this amendment? Okay. Do you want to talk about the dash?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dash 2, which we presented to you back in February, is proposed to actually divert penalty revenue that would come in, and it's not our intent at DEQ to actually do extensive enforcement, but any revenue that would come in, instead of going into the general fund, it would be diverted over to basically the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, and the money then could be used for groundwater protection grants.
We have somebody from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board here. I'm wondering, do you want to come up, say anything about this, since you're being designated as the receptor?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Leone, and I'm with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. And we are willing and capable of accepting these funds and administering through them through our regular grant program if there are penalties available to use.
Okay, any questions about this proposal? Representative Kirsten?
Thank you, Madam Chair. But this is really a follow-on to what Representative Cannon was probing. But it resonates with an observation I had about the original bill, which was that it seemed difficult to understand how you first found out that you were subject to this area of regulation. And the Dash 3 amendments seem to perpetuate that same situation. That is, there is a determination that is made that there's an environmental risk to groundwater, and that triggers the $100 fee. But how do you get the information as an agency to know to make that determination so that a person then understands that they have to get a permit? I'll throw that out to the panel and let whoever is best suited. Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, typically that is done through the building review process, so when you're going for a development permit or a building permit, and when you go to a city or a county and seek that approval to go forward, that's when there would be a checkoff to see if there would actually be a UIC or an underground injection control component to your development. So don't think about existing family residences or commercial. It's when there's a new project being proposed.
Okay.
Follow-up?
Okay.
But who makes that determination, though? I mean, I understand that there's a permitting process for a new project. Somebody wants to... In this case here, we're talking about a common roof drain. So somebody's putting in place a residence. They're building a new residence that happens to be in an area, well, just any place. They're putting in a new residence that's got a common roof drain, and they go in to get a permit for the construction of that structure. Who would decide that there is an environmental risk from the drainage coming off of that roof such that you need to be over in this underground injection regulatory process?
Representative Pearson, we have a local member of the audience that's going to explain to you, because I think it's correct. It's the city and county permitting process where that trigger would happen, and maybe you can explain for us, walk us through how that process works, and for the record.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative McPherson, my name is Shannon Taylor. I'm with the Groundwater Protection Coalition, which is a stakeholder group supporting this bill. I also work for the City of Edmond. With most of the jurisdictions that are part of the Groundwater Protection Coalition, through the development review process, if someone is proposing putting in one of these devices, it's listed as a condition of approval that they receive DEQ approval or rule authorization of the device. So DEQ has their own process of reviewing individual dry wells or drill holes as proposed. So, and that's what's required by the Oregon administrative rules. So,
and just to clarify, part of the reason why you're supporting this bill is because the fact that the department hasn't had the staff to review this process in a timely manner, so that's actually held up your development review process. Is that correct?
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, yes. The process can take over 90 days currently, and it holds up development by our development community. The proposed turnaround times are less than 45 days, even for the most complex, with this bill being passed.
And if you recall, committee members, we heard from a whole series of cities about why they were supporting this, because of this challenge that they find when they have customers come in, citizens that come in to try to get their permits processed. It's not held up by the cities or counties. It's held up by the DEQ. So follow up, and then Representative Burley. We want to make sure
there's still a missing piece, and maybe I'm being too dense, but it sounds like what you're saying is that every project that requires a building permit that has an underground drain down into the soil then would require somebody to make a determination about whether there was an environmental risk created by that. And then if there was, when that determination is made, then there's the $100 permitting process for a subsurface injection well. So what I'm curious about is who makes that determination that there's an environmental risk to groundwater? And on what information?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, I think that if I can take a moment and explain the process on how we address UIC applications at DEQ. When we receive a permit application at DEQ, we look at several factors, including where it's located to a drinking water well. In this case, where we're looking at in relation to industrial facilities nearby. And we would be cross-checking with...
Can I just break in, because I think we're getting off track here. I mean, you're talking about what you do at DEQ. I'm talking about the person who's at the front end of the process. They're putting in the residential project, which has got a drainage... So how do they get you guys involved? How do you even get the front end of this process?
Chair Dingsell, their representative, McPherson. It's part of the rules. So in order for a UIC system to go in the first place, before it's constructed, it has to be rule authorized by DEQ or permitted. So it's part of the risk of the community accepting, you know, we have, in my case, we are 100% drinking water source is groundwater. So by keeping, you know, contaminants from going into the groundwater, it's part of our managing that risk to make sure that all of the systems meet DEQ's rule authorization.
And if I may, so, for instance, you probably have your checklist for anybody who comes in and gets a development permit, and on it is if you're looking at putting in, you know, an injection well or sump or whatever, then you would let them know right up front that they need to get DEQ approval. It's probably in your checklist.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Okay. So there's a, I could have introduced to you, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
So what happens is, short of this $100 fee permitting process, there's a threshold determination in which a person in the development process states whether they're putting in a common residential drain, and then somebody at that front end, at DEQ, makes a determination, we think there's an environmental risk or there isn't, and there's no fee paid for that determination.
Well, there hasn't been.
Correct.
Right.
And even now, under this proposal, there still wouldn't be until, based on that initial threshold information, DEQ decided, yes, there's an environmental risk, and then there would be a $100 fee.
Correct. Okay. So is that...
Thank you for your indulgence.
So, and that's one of the reasons that we saw so much support for this from the cities and counties, who are the people up front at the counter that deal with developers, builders, residents, industrial customers that are not getting their permits turned around in a timely manner. But it's not because of the city's fault, but because DEQ doesn't have the staff to process and move that part of the permit application forward. Is that correct?
Chairing further, committee members, yes. And I've actually had developers on the phone say, I would pay $10,000 to have this reviewed today. You're holding up my project.
So obviously we should be increasing the fee level there. Okay, Representative Burley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to go back to some of the earlier questions by Representative Cannon. Did I understand correctly that the sub A that's being added in the -3 amendments is to pick up the residential development?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, actually, it's to exempt residential development for the most part.
This is not my day for exempt.
It is to exempt the single-family roof drain.
Yes. And hence, then, the term common roof drain. That's how we're getting at that.
Correct.
Thank you.
So, clarification, follow-up on Representative Burley's question. Multi-family unit, it would not be exempted. So when you say single, so for instance, it's a duplex or, you know, a four apartments together.
Madam Chair, actually, it would include duplexes and up to at least triplexes.
And is that because it's just the threshold of the amount of water coming off the roof is still under what you consider to be at this risk level? I mean, that's what I'm trying to... Is it because of the surface area of the roof is what you're looking at, or is that the trigger, or...
Madam Chair, yes, it'd be both the footprint, the square footage, the amount of runoff, and location.
Okay, any questions from down in that end? It's been awfully quiet. Okay.
Sorry, Madam Chair?
Yes?
So what is the meaning of common roof drain?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, common roof drain is just basically collecting the roof water runoff and sending it to a...
You say single. So, for instance, it's a duplex or, you know, a four apartments together.
Madam Chair, actually, it would include duplexes and up to at least triplexes.
And is that because it's just the threshold of the amount of water coming off the roof is still under what you consider to be at this risk level? I mean, that's what I'm trying to... Is it because of the surface area of the roof is what you're looking at, or is that the trigger, or...
Madam Chair, yes, it'd be both the footprint, the square footage, the amount of runoff, and location.
Okay, any questions from down in that end? It's been awfully quiet. Okay.
So, sorry, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So what is the meaning of common roof drain?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, common roof drain is just basically collecting the roof water runoff and sending it to a underground injection control device such as a dry well or a soakage trench. It's just a means of collecting roof runoff.
Right. So this actually, A is referring to just any household. It's not the exemption here. Is the exemption that you're saying will be granted through the rules process.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an exemption that's in the bill itself. The bill itself has been written such that DEQ could decide, as you explained, I think, in response to my questions, that for certain single-family houses, the environmental risk is such that they're required to go obtain the permit for the UIC, which I think is sensible. But just to be clear on that.
Yeah, I will follow up on Representative Cannon's question because I've never seen common. I mean, is that a term of art? Because I've not seen common roof drain, so I was curious about what that referred to. Is that Legislative Council?
Madam Chair, that was actually language from our legal folks. Okay. So I think that's a standard term of art, Mike Espa. You can research that more if you'd like.
That's okay. I mean, that's what I take it when I read that. That's what I take it to mean. So, okay, any other questions about the fee structure? The question I have is when you would initiate rulemaking, by the way, if this bill passes.
Madam Chair, our understanding is it would be within the 2007-2009 biennium that we would initiate the rulemaking.
So this is already anticipated in your budget?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
And the intent, if I could just explain, is to have it passed by statute, and then once rulemaking is complete, then it would drop out of statute and stay in as rule. That's the way the language has been set up.
Okay. And can you just explain the reasoning for that? Why you have to have... So you don't have the authority to just do it through rulemaking currently.
Correct.
Okay.
This provides statutory authority to charge and establish a fee program that we currently do not have for the underground injection control program.
And then in the future, if you are looking at fee increases, you will be doing that through legislative. You'll have to come back to the legislature to make those changes, since it's in statute.
Madam Chair, no. Once we establish rulemaking and set fees through rules, and the intent is initially the fees would be identical to what you're saying here legislatively,
mm-hmm.
but from that point on, then all the fees would be done through the rulemaking process, not through the legislative process. But of course, at every session, the legislature does approve the fees that have been adopted in the past year or past 2 years by the Environmental Quality Commission.
Madam Chair, if I may add, the legislature in the end has final oversight on those fee increases. They need to return back. I think they do it through the revenue and the Ways and Means process to get ratification of those fees. And so there still is legislative oversight.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Hey, any other questions? I think we're finally muddling through here on these different
Madam Chair,
amendments.
Just further on that, I think that it is pretty much standard practice to have this by rule. The only time that we typically see it just by statute is where the agency may have been in trouble in some way, and in which case the legislature might at that time put the fee in statute and remove their ability to do it by rule.
I was going to say Water Resources Department is all in statute.
Well, we never have been able to trust Water Resources.
Okay. Well, as I said, there seems to be no rhyme or reason with our fee structure in this state, because some agencies have it in statute and others go through the rulemaking process. So, all right, thank you for that additional insight. Any other questions? We'll accept the motion on the amendments.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 and -3 amendments to House Bill 2118.
Okay, Representative Cannon moves the -2 and the -3 amendments to House Bill 2118. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, motion carries, and the -2, -3 amendments have been adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2118 as amended by the dash 2 and dash 3 to the floor with due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Cannon moves House Bill 2118 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And actually, it's the House Bill 2118 as amended by the dash 2 and dash 3 amendments. So that was the opinion that the amended version of House Bill 2118 should be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. With due pass recommendation, we vote aye. Those opposed, vote no. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative King?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Nieko?
Aye. So the motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2118. Senator Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you allowing me to make this motion. Madam Chair, request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting aye on the motion on, I think it's the motion to approve House Bill 2172.
Okay, Representative Smith requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow him to record an aye vote on House Bill 2172. Are there any objections? Okay, seeing none. So ordered.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Okay, thank you. And with that, we will close our work session portion of the meeting and open up a public hearing on SJM 1 relating to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate Joint Memorial 1 urges Congress to fund cleanup efforts at Hanford Nuclear Reservation and expedite cleanup actions in order to safeguard public health and welfare and protect the Columbia River.
Okay, thank you. I am going to call up Ken Niles, and I see Mike Rainey is here also. Is Ken here?
Ken left.
Okay. We bored him with all of our amendments discussion. So Mike Rainey from the Department of Energy will provide an overview of the bill for us. Mike.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. Mike Rainey from Department of Energy. SJM 1 is a memorial urging Congress to fully fund cleanup at Hanford, the Hanford site in the state of Washington, and provide Oregon a role in the decisions made there. Very briefly, Hanford is located near the Tri-Cities in southeastern Washington State. It's a federal Department of Energy facility that was the site of nuclear weapons production during and after World War II. There's no longer active weapons production being made, but the site is heavily contaminated with radioactive waste materials. Over 1,000 different sites are contaminated, many with high-level radioactive wastes. Wastes, in some cases, have gone deep into the soil and contaminated groundwater. Groundwater, in turn, presents a threat to the Columbia River, because ultimately that groundwater goes into the Columbia River. There are also trenches within a few yards of the Columbia River itself that are contaminated. In addition, in the event of a major accident at Hanford, people in Oregon would be at risk that are within the 50-mile emergency planning radius for nuclear facilities. Finally, the report that I've just handed out is a report we do every 2 years on transportation of radioactive materials through the state. Virtually every shipment into and out of Hanford goes through the state of Oregon for over 200 miles. There are risks in transporting radioactive wastes. We work with the shippers to certify safe shipments, and we work with them on when they ship, so they don't ship in bad weather, but there are risks from shipments, and we train emergency responders along the transport routes to know how to respond if there's an accident. But the cover photo there is just outside of Pendleton and shows the type of trucks. These are large trucks carrying heavy volumes of material and have to be treated very carefully. Finally, the decisions to which sites on Hanford to clean up and what time frame is made by, under an agreement called the Hanford Tri-Party Agreement. The three parties are the state of Washington, the U.S. Department of Energy, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Oregon has no legal role, although we obviously have great interest and concerns on Hanford cleanup. We have memorandum of understanding in terms of sharing information with the federal government and state of Washington, but it's not the same as being involved in the actual decision making, and that would take federal legislation to acquire, and that's part of the memorial as well. This is a memorial that has been requested initially by our Hanford Cleanup Board. Representative Jensen has been a member of that board for many years in the past, and as well as other legislators have served as non-voting members as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions or elaborate further if you'd like.
Representative Jensen, would you like to add anything since this travels through your district? And actually, I was going to say it travels all along I-84. Is that correct? So
yes,
it actually
yes.
goes from my district as well.
Yes. All the shipments go through I-84, and many of them go up and down I-5 as well.
What's the ultimate destination for the spent fuel?
For shipments that are leaving Hanford, there's a disposal site in New Mexico, so actually a number of shipments will go east on I-84 when they leave Hanford. That's for the transuranic wastes. Most of the shipments coming into Hanford, they could be from anywhere in the country, including from California, and also from Puget Sound.
One question, I can comment a little bit, but one question, Mike. Is the naval program still decommissioning and shipping up the Columbia River?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, not currently. The level activity has been greatly reduced in the last 2 years. I think there's only been one shipment. These are submarine hulls from the Bremerton Naval Shipyard, and they're sent by barge rather than by truck or rail. They're too large, and they come through Puget Sound down the Oregon or the Washington coast and come up the Columbia River to Hanford. And we have had, as the report talks about, a series of these over the years, but in the last 2 years, I think there's only been one. And the amount of submarine hulls being decommissioned is very few at this point.
But if there are any to be decommissioned in the future, they probably will make the same
yes.
voyage up the river that previous hulls have made up there. And just as a matter of yes. note, Madam Chair, one time driving along the freeway back from back from some sort of activity down here at the state capitol, I saw one of these barges going up the river with that hull on it. Very easy to recognize if you see it going up there. And these, I think, are potentially very hot since they're part of the generating facility of the in the submarine. The comment on this, I believe, and Mike can verify this or correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe the situation is much improved from what it was when I first became involved with the Oregon Hanford Waste Cleanup. And there's been progress made, but unfortunately it's a huge expense. Billions and billions of dollars are needed to go into this. And the Congress of the United States is not unlike the Oregon legislature when it gets to the end of the funding session and we start marking up bills. Some items don't come as high up on the priority list as other items do. And I think it's been my observation that this has been an item that has been moved down a few times, and I think we are somewhat obligated, if you wish, Madam Chair, to continue to encourage the United States Congress to address this problem in all earnesty and in all seriousness, to get it cleaned up, because most of that material is not going to run out its half-life in our full life.
Time standard, time. Correct.
So, if we don't take care of it now, believe me, your great-great-grandchildren will have the opportunity to be working on it, and that's just far too long for us to have not taken more aggressive steps than we have been able to complete.
Well, thank you, Representative Jensen. I appreciate your remarks, and I know that you have been working on this for a long time, so appreciate your support of this. Representative Gurley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, just want to make sure we understand the whole implications of seeking standing, the state of Oregon seeking standing under the Hanford Tri-Party Agreement. What sort of obligations might be binding on the state of Oregon if we were to be successful in that endeavor?
I'm Chair Representative Gurley. I think the only obligation would be to participate as much as we wanted in the issues and decisions that would be made. It would definitely give us access to information we don't have now. It would give us access to participate in decisions on prioritizing at the site, because as Representative Jensen pointed out, there certainly has been significant progress in some areas over the last few years, but there's other areas, because of lack of funding, that have not received top priority. And in terms of the tri-party agreement milestones that drive the budget decisions and where priorities are made with the amount of budget Congress appropriates, that's made by those three parties.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Cannon.
Madam Chair, thank you. The memorial refers to storage facilities that have failed. Are those what are referred to in our staff measure summary, the 67 leaking tanks?
Chair, President Finn, that's correct. And these are large underground tanks holding liquid and semi-liquid sludgy waste. It's very high level radioactive waste. That's the most dangerous part of the waste at the site.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Sure.
Those are tanks that, when they went in, had, what, a 50-year life expectancy? That life expectancy has long since come and gone.
Yes.
That's correct.
And it has, for those of you folks who aren't familiar, the groundwater contamination issue was a pretty big issue, started about 20 years ago, or even earlier, was it in the 50s? And it's been a big issue for a while, and that, for the communities around there, I've dealt with the groundwater cleanup for a long, long time. And my understanding now, they're looking at vitrification, actually treating it on site instead of removing that material. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, for the high level of waste, and the vitrifying being strained into glass, it would still be radioactive, but it would be a lot safer and easier to handle, and it would be stored on site unless a permanent repository is opened up. Yucca Mountain could take high level waste both from commercial reactors and from federal facilities like Hanford.
Thank you. We have Doug Griggs, who would like to come up, and maybe if he can stick around, Mike, in case there's other questions. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs. I'm a board member and the founding member of the Hanford Information Network. We are a 501c3 organization formed in 1997 and been very actively involved in Hanford cleanup since that time. We primarily focus on educational outreach activities. We have a program through the Department of Ecology in Washington through which we have been out to about 568 schools around the state of Washington to talk about environmental cleanup in Hanford and the Columbia River. We've presented materials to over 7,000 high school students through that program. We also participate extensively with the public outreach program. Mr. Greeny and his excellent staff at the Department of Energy help coordinate in Oregon. And I guess I'd just make a few quick comments. There's some handouts coming around. I think it's important to keep in mind, and Representative Jensen alluded to this is a gigantic undertaking, and it's something that most people in Northwest have forgotten about. This is two-thirds of the legacy of the Cold War's production of nuclear waste. We're talking about 53 million gallons of underground nuclear waste stored in 177 tanks, 67 of which have leaked in the past. Until recently, we're talking about 2,300 metric tons of nuclear fuel, legacy of the 1970s and early 1980s that were corroding, decaying, stored in basically gigantic swimming pools less than 400 yards away from the Columbia River. We're talking about millions and millions of tons of contaminated soil and groundwater that is also a legacy of the Cold War. The annual budget for Hanford for 2008 is $1.94 billion. It is the largest environmental cleanup program underway any place in the world. Not just the U.S., but any place in the world. You could argue that in the Soviet Union we have a significantly higher amount of contamination and less retention of those contaminants, but very little is going on in many of those locations. And so the potential impact to citizens in Washington State, even in Idaho, and of course in Oregon, is dramatic. And so what our group really is focused on is trying to keep up the public pressure on Congress that as we get further and further away from World War II and the Cold War, people remember why it's important to keep investing public dollars in these programs. I did want to point out a couple of things. If you look at the handout that I gave you, this summary of headlines that I clipped out from the last 6 or 7 months, I think what you'll see is the frustration that all of us who work on Hanford issues encounter on a daily basis, which is you have a tremendous number of very good people at Hanford working very diligently every year to try to get this enormous environmental problem cleaned up. But because it's such an enormous problem, and because many of these cleanup issues are issues that do not have technology that have been used before for environmental cleanup, it's, you know, two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, two steps back, or two steps forward and five steps back in some occasions. Fortunately, I think we have made quite a bit of progress, and in my written testimony I've outlined five or six areas where significant progress has been made. The last thing I'll point out is I handed out a little flyer that we produced about a year and a half ago, and we saw an awful lot of parallels between the failure of the federal government to take care of the levees in the New Orleans area and the failure of the federal government to take care of those tanks and the tank issues at Hanford. We've gone through a period of several years, two or three years now, where we believe that the underground tank cleanup program, the vitrification program, has been significantly underfunded. We think we've turned a corner, and we think that the budget request for 2008, which is $690 million just for that one program, is sufficient to get the program back on track. But even in that case, we're talking about a program that, under the best scenario, will not start turning waste to glass until 2014. So we've already spent $3.5 billion. We'll probably spend another $8 to $12 billion on that project. And really, we'll start turning that underground nuclear waste into glass. It'll be 2013. The high-level waste won't be until 2017 or 2018. So the comment that Representative Jensen made about our grandkids still being available to do work on this project is pretty much applicable. So we want to thank you for holding the hearing today. It is very important that we continue to stay up to date on what's going on in Hanford, that we continue to communicate with Congress about the need. What the DOE has done over the past 4 or 5 years is slowly clean up sites one by one, and of course that's fantastic from an environmental standpoint, but what that leaves us with is fewer members of Congress who have environmental cleanup sites in their district, and that's it's a game of numbers. So we appreciate your efforts here and thank the department. They've been great to work with over the last decade, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Doug. Any questions? I'm sorry, Doug, I had a question for you. The geographic scope of your nonprofit, I'm assuming this is Oregon, Washington members, and how, I'm just curious how you were formed. Was that just concern about making sure that there was good information out there about the cleanup? And
yeah, there are a number of really dedicated groups in Oregon. Columbia River Keeper is one of the groups based in Hood River. Hanford Watch is based in Portland. Hanford Information Network, we have about 1,000 members in Oregon and Washington mostly. And I had actually worked on Hanford issues when I worked back in Washington, D.C., and came back and wanted to focus mainly on tank issues. And so our group was formed primarily to do that. And also, we really saw a niche in environmental outreach. Convincing kids in high school science classes that there's a career for them, a career path for them as they go into college, or if they want to get involved in the trades, as an example, is something that is one of our key objectives. And so, you know, you can look at the numbers. We've been out to a lot of high schools, and we've helped put classes together with college programs from time to time, and really think that that's an important element here. And most, it's interesting, if we go to a high school west of the mountains and we ask for a show of hands how many people know where Hanford is, we're lucky if we get two or three hands out of 30 kids. If we go to a high school east of the mountains, we'll probably have half the kids or more raise their hands that at least know where Hanford is. But the level of understanding, I think, contributes to a lack of interest in the environmental sciences, environmental cleanup, environmental technology, and one of our goals is to try to remediate that.
I appreciate it, and they can learn about being an environmental consultant and have a lifetime of work.
There we go.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Well, I worked for a firm that 20 years ago was working on that. That's when we were working on the groundwater contamination cleanup, and it's never ending. Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Anybody else who would like to testify on SJM 1?
Okay. Madam Chair.
And Representative Jensen.
Just
closing comments.
A lot of good comments by both Mike and Mr. Eggs about this. But it's comforting to know that we have the single largest environmental risk in the country.
Right here in the Northwest.
Right here in the Northwest, of ready, able, and willing to start dumping some of its environmentally risky materials into that river that flows by the city of Portland. It really is a huge, huge problem. And we have a moral responsibility, I think, to keep this in front of people's eyes so that we don't forget about it. Because these things are easy to forget about. And when we forget about them, then if the pressure isn't there, as we all know what the pressure does when it comes to bear in this building, same thing I'm sure applies in Washington. And if we take the pressure off, it goes on the back burner.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you for your comments, Representative Jensen. I wholeheartedly agree that hopefully we can send a strong message with this joint memorial, because it is something, like you said, that we need to continue to light the fire under our congressional delegation about how important the funding for the cleanup of this huge project that ended up in our backyards.
That's not my backyard.
It's our front yard.
Yes, that's true. It's our front yard. It's our front yard. And we know, well, many people rely on the Columbia for their water supply, so it's a big concern. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. And with that, I'll close the hearing on SJM 1. And last, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 89. If you can give us an overview, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 89 extends to June 30, 2010, the sunset on a Water Resources Department pilot project allowing temporary transfer of water rights in certain irrigation districts.
Okay, thank you. Debbie Colbert from the Water Resources Department. And I recall hearing this bill in Representative Jensen's Water Committee 2 years ago. So I think you're back to tell us about it. There's no information, but just it's saying the sunset, just so you know. But it says remove language and add some, so you may want to read that. Well, that was in strange categories. This is different. You'll hear. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department. Senate Bill 89 is a bill that was pre-session filed by the governor on behalf of the Water Resources Department and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. And for the record, I'm Debbie Colbert with the Water Resources Department. Senate Bill 89 is a bill that was pre-session filed by the governor on behalf of the Water Resources Department and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. And it extends a current pilot program for 2 more years. And this pilot program was really designed to see if there were opportunities to allow irrigation districts more flexibility to move water around within their districts annually, without removing any of the existing protections for other existing water rights. For the pilot program that was created in 2003, three districts were identified specifically, and that was Talent Irrigation District, Tualatin Valley Irrigation District, and Oahe Irrigation District. The department is requesting to extend the irrigation, the pilot program for two more years. Although it was created in 2003, it took a couple years both for the districts, the pilot districts, and the department to be in a place to start implementing this pilot. And so we have only had only two out of the three districts have been able to use this opportunity, and one of them for just one irrigation season. So we are asking to have two more years of running the pilot so that we can more accurately assess how it's working. Can these this increased flexibility be done while still protecting other water rights and water right holders? Thank you. Any questions for Debbie? We have just one witness that would like to come up. Actually, why don't we have Anita Winkler come up, and then if you can stay up here, we'll see if there's questions for both, because I think Anita can give us some on-the-ground examples. It might be helpful. Thank you, Anita.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We are the trade association that represents the irrigation districts involved in this pilot project. I'm not sure I can give you very much on the ground because there's not much on the ground to tell you about, but we're here to express our appreciation to the department for the request to extend the sunset. The three districts that are involved were very concerned about losing this ability without having a chance to really give it a full trial run from their perspective. So far, they found it very helpful, but just limited because of the time frame it took to get the project up and running. You have my written testimony in front of you. I'm not going to read it to you today, but we're very appreciative.
Okay. I have just a question, and maybe Representative Jensen might remember this, but I don't. I'm just curious how we ended up picking those, or did the department end up picking those three districts for the pilot? My former irrigation district, Tualatin Valley. So was that they stepped forward and said, this is a tool we really need, or how were those three chosen?
I'll tackle that question. This was our bill 2 years ago. We suggested those three districts, but they needed the approval of the department. We were looking for three districts that are in different parts of the state and operating under very different conditions, both geographically and with their climate and with the needs of their water users, because we wanted to give this the broadest test that we could possibly do it. And all of those, I'm not sure you ever say an irrigation district volunteers. They either volunteered or were gently volunteered.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Jensen, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have no recall that anybody in those three districts volunteered. I got the feeling it was payback for something, but I never figured out what it was payback. I guess the question I have, how many in this period of time, how many transfers have actually taken place?
Madam Chair, Representative, in 2005, we had six transfers that were for a total of 14 acres done in Talent Irrigation District. And then in 2006 irrigation season, Talent did four transfers or moved, you know, did four place of use changes involving 8 acres. And Tualatin Valley Irrigation District did one change in place of use that involved over 5,000 acres within their district.
And
Follow up.
And the other guy still on second.
Madam Chair, Representative, Oahe Irrigation District is anticipating using this program this irrigation season, 2007.
Okay. So our action would not inhibit their ability to complete their transfer.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct, but it would give them a couple more years to test out this this pilot.
Okay, I'm, of course, I think probably like you all, a little bit concerned about the lack of use.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what this tells us. I'd like to maybe ask Anita if she has anything other than the short time frame that she hears from her people in relationship to it. This is, and if I enlarge that a little bit, as I understand, this is a relatively user-friendly statute that there isn't a lot of difficulty involved as far as the districts are concerned or individuals are concerned, if that's correct. So what is it that seems, other than time, to be the problem, if anything?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Jensen, I think there was several factors. One is it took over a year to get the rules in place, by which time we're kind of in the middle of running water, and you don't talk to districts about very much during when they're running water. They just aren't real amenable to conversations. A couple of things. I think in Tualatin Valley we were waiting to get their water rights certificated, mm-hmm. and they are now certificated, so they've begun to participate. The interesting problem in Oahe, you may remember when we originally testified on this, they were very interested in this because of the drought. Well, last year their problem was they had too much water, and they really spent all their time trying to make sure they weren't flooding out Nyssa and Ontario and managing the water in the reservoir. So they didn't have time to worry about anything like this, and our indications are they're going to have a lot of water this year, but they're functioning much better, and they will be able to use it and move the water around. So it's just kind of a series of different things that happened in time, and they all came together at one time. We have several other districts who were very interested in being added to this, and when talking to the department, we thought, in the spirit of why we originally had passed it, that we needed to hold it to those three districts and give it another couple years. But there's some other districts who may be smaller districts who actually see this as more beneficial.
And this is a temporary transfer. Can you tell me what the time elements are on the transfers that have taken place?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, for the changes that have happened to the pilot program, they can only be annual place of use changes that can be done through the pilot. All other permanent changes or longer term or involving the point of diversion, they have to go through the regular application process.
Yes, I understand that. Wasn't really where I was going. How do I rephrase this?
Representative, are you looking at the time frame it takes to actually process one of these?
No. I'm looking at the time frame of operation. We referred to them as temporary transfer of water rights. Temporary means what?
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, that's temporary. It's for only one irrigation season.
For only one irrigation season. Mm-hmm. So they have to resubmit the next irrigation season.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
And it is possible to resubmit and resubmit and resubmit. And have we had any resubmits at this point?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that in the Talent Irrigation District area, the only district that's used it for two seasons now, there may have been some resubmits, but not all of them were resubmits.
Any feedback? Excuse me, Madam
okay.
Chair.
Follow up.
Any feedback from the people on the, you know, the resubmits or failure to? To the water.
Madam Chair, Representative Jensen, in terms of feedback, we haven't heard any complaints of injury or enlargement as a result of these districts using this flexibility, and our water masters haven't reported any issues of injury and enlargement.
Madam Chair, I'm not in opposition to this. That's not why I'm asking questions. I'll be supportive when we get to work session. I just wanted to know a little more than I know at the present time about it, and I appreciate the answers, and I would agree that a couple of years more would probably be beneficial to check the program and see how people are responding to it, what the attitudes are on the ground, with it.
I have a question for the department as far as, is there any threshold about how many times, you spoke this question for me, Representative Jensen, how many times an irrigation district can come back for a temporary transfer before you say, okay, guess what, folks, it's time to do a permanent transfer and go through the regular application process. So that's the question I had. I mean, are we there yet? We haven't done this long enough. I mean, is the department going to say, okay, this, you know, you can have five times and then you have to go for a permanent transfer? Madam Chair, there is no cap on the number of times you can repeat these annual changes. I think that one inherent cap is that it would save districts that aren't part of this pilot program, it would save them money to do these on a longer-term permanent basis, ultimately, rather than having to pay annual application fees. So it's a cross driver.
Madam Chair, if I might, in the Talent, I'd hate to see a cap put on. For instance, in the Talent Irrigation District, their contract with the Bureau of Reclamation requires that every transfer get approval from the Bureau. Usually that happens fairly quickly. In some instances, it is painstakingly long to get it, and this allows them to go ahead and do that temporary transfer because someone doesn't want to use the water anymore and someone else does want it. So they just need to do it every year until they actually get that approval and then can carry through the final action as a permanent transfer.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Cannon.
When you're transferring, thank you, when you're transferring water rights within an irrigation district on a temporary basis, how do you know that you're moving the right amount of water from one user to the other? And what's the mechanism whereby you know that you're not over-reaching the sort of value or what's been permitted under the delegation?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative, for a regular district temporary transfer, there is an application process, there's a map that has to be prepared by a certified water right examiner, and then there's also the regular measurement and mapping requirements and water master review. For districts that are participating in this pilot program, they have to have an accurate map on hand that describes the place and acres that would be associated with these changes and have it available for the water master to inspect, and they also have to have measure all of their measurement requirements up to date as well.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you so much. Well, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 89, and we will close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee and get off again.